part four, I think it is. Sabrina George still interviewing Nick Wilty for New Comedy Radio. Yeah, talking about fame. That's what I wanted to ask you. Why aren't you doing your one-man show, touring it around Britain all the time, doing arts venues?
Oh, partly laziness.
Right.
And I think you've got to be a certain... got to have a certain idea what you want in your career. I mean, Dominic Holland does that. Booth B. Greffel does that. You know, tours, art theatres and that. It's all a bit prim and proper for me.
I'm
a rough and tumble guy. I like going to a different place every night or a different country every week, ideally. And, you know, sort of taking on an audience. Not having, you know, people think, oh, yeah, so I've read your book. Awfully funny. I wonder if it was funny in person. Then sit there and wait till the end and then clap you. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that may well happen. I think my manager's got plans for that. When I'm writing this book, as I say, if that gets published, he wants me to do the Soho Theatre and an Edinburgh run and art theatres and that. Maybe I'll find that that's my niche, but that'll be because I've got a specific thing to talk about. You know, 25 years after the Falklands, I'm excised, I'm getting out of my system, I'm talking about it. And I'm happy with the book so far. I've only written four chapters, but it's me, it's funny, it's quirky, it's how I see life, and it's rude, and there's bits of me in there that I'm not proud of, but it is me.
But it's true.
Yeah, yeah, I was a fighter and a drinker when I was in the army, so there's no point in holding back there. And again, going back to the class thing, I'm quite derogatory about officers in there. You know, we had one particular officer, and I used a phrase the other day about him. He was scared of working class people, he was scared of regional accents, and he really was. He just couldn't stop blinking when he talked to people like me. It just put him on edge, you know. And I don't like that. I would like to be regarded as an equal, not inferior in any way or superior. And this bloody class system over here has got... If I was an Australian or a Canadian, I'd just be regarded as a good comic, not a good working class comic or a, you know, Jack the Ladder. Where I'd just be a bloke. I'd just be an ordinary run-of-the-mill bloke who just happens to have this accent. Because I've got it and I'm lumbered with it, I get pigeonholed. But I think what may happen with this book, it puts me in a position where I'm able to do the very thing that I've avoided for years, and maybe it will suit me, I don't know, but it's a bit more serious than... I don't think me going around doing an hour of my best comedy in art centres is for me. I know it's what Dominic does and what Boothby does, and I'm sure lots of people out there doing it and aspire to that, and certainly they earn about four times as much as me, you know. I mean, I earn a decent living, but they earn a very nice living, and if that's what you want, fine, you know. If it happens with a book, it'll be a different scenario for me. I've been talking about something that's very important to my life and integral to making me the way I am, and maybe that's the right audience for it. I never talk about the Falklands or the army on stage in the comedy club because I can't dip in and out of it. It's all or nothing.
Yeah.
So maybe in the art centres next year, when I've got a book on the go, and if the book's sold any, maybe I'll sell 10,000 copies of it and 10,000 people spread throughout the country, then I go, oh yeah, I've heard of them, I'll go and see them.
But fundamentally, you do love the clubs.
Oh, I love them.
Yeah.
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
And I like the format of clubs as well, where it's a compere, an actor, headliner, whatever, you know. And I don't care where I am in that bit. I don't care if I'm a compere, the opener, the closer. I know I've got an ego, so does everyone else. It's not an ego in terms of, oh, I have to be the closing act, or I have, you know, if I compere, I'm on stage more often. I just want to have a good night out, you know.
Yeah.
The more I enjoy myself on stage, the more the audience enjoy it. And it's self-replicating, and I love working on a bill with people that I like, you know. I mean, the first thing I do when I get booked overseas, I say, what date is it, see if it fits in, who's on with me. And sometimes I'll cancel the gig because I don't want to spend 2 weeks in some exotic country, some boring bloke who doesn't travel, or someone who sits around talking about himself all day, and not my cup of tea, you know. See what I mean?
Yeah.
That's my job.
That's your job. So things like going into acting, or because I mean, at the moment, the amount of emails going around about, you know, can you deliver a format for this? Can you come and audition for that? Can you come on this? No, they don't happen to me that often, thank God. But you know, the amount of game shows, quiz shows, panel games, etc., that are trying to find a formula that works for comics.
Of course,
it's almost tragic, in fact. There's very few that I think actually work.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, they've got to make a living. They're trying to churn out shows all the time, and they've realised we're an easy commodity. We're sort of house trained. We're used to microphones and audiences. You plonk us in front, we've got something to say. I did a bit of acting last year. I was in this thing called Cattle Drive, where I played a Confederate soldier, Cockney Confederate. Federal Soldier, which was Andy. It was written for me by Rich Hill and Mike Wilmot, so I was very happy with that. Now, I really enjoyed it, and the producer presumed I'd acted before because I talked it like a duck to water. I even sort of improvised and made my own lines up, but I always checked them with Rich and say, can I throw in a little line I thought of that would fit the character, and he was good about it. Now, I'd like that. I'd like to do more of that. And I was, funnily enough, in Edinburgh last year, I ran into a guy who used to be in EastEnders. He was one of the DeMarco brothers. And we were chatting, and he said to me, have you been in EastEnders? I went, no, I'm a comedian, aren't I? He went, yeah, I know, but he said, you've got the accent, you've got the look. Why don't you go to EastEnders? I said, well, I've never acted before. He said, have you seen the show? And then he said, you know, do you know Shane Ritchie? I went, yeah, a little bit from when he was on the circuit years ago. I said, and he went, well, you could do that, couldn't you? He said, you could try a little bit of acting, basically, if you're playing yourself. I mean, I could be somebody's long-lost brother or uncle or something, couldn't I? Or somebody's bloody stepfather or something, you know? So I haven't ruled it out. It's just that I've got no burning ambition to be famous. That's the little taste I had of fame in the 90s was a pain in the arse, to be honest. I enjoyed the filming of the show and meeting all these celebrities, and it was great, you know? I mean, who wouldn't enjoy it? You know, spending 2 hours with Kylie Minogue or something. You know, it's good fun. But when you're on your night bus or you're in a pub that night and suddenly comes, hey, how's Kylie? Hey, you know, it's like you become this public face that I don't like. And I remember Terry Wogan years ago being interviewed on a, I think it was a TV show, I think it was when he did all his chat show and that, and then he went on Parky or something. They said, have you got any regrets? And he went, yeah, yeah, I wish I'd stayed on radio. He said, because everybody knew me. I had fame, but they didn't know who I was. He said, so I could walk the street without being, hey, Terry. He said, if I spoke, people said, you don't know, I sound like that Terry Wogan. He'd say, yeah, I am. So he could turn his choose fame it on and off, yeah, you know. And I met Frederick Forsyth once, the writer, because he owns a nice yacht, and I used to work on yachts, you know. We're down in Gibraltar, and I didn't know who he was, and we were chatting, and I said, that is a fantastic boat you've got. How do you afford a boat like that? And he said, I've written some fairly successful books. And I went, oh, right. Like, what? Would I have heard of them? And because he said Day of the Jackal. I went, wow. Oh, blimey, no wonder you can afford that. I said, it must be brilliant. You got all that and nobody knows who you are. And he went, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the ultimate fame. You name his book and they go, oh, my God, that is the best book I've ever read. But he could sit here, he'd be in that bar there. You wouldn't open a bar at all. And, I mean, I've met a lot of famous people. And I wouldn't want to be any of them. Yeah, I'd love to have all the perks that go with it. I mean, I'd like to have Robbie Williams' social life, but I wouldn't like to be Robbie Williams. You know, I'd like to have a backlog of, you know, Paul McCartney saying, this is what I've done in my life, but I wouldn't want to be him and have that thing of people knowing who you are and all about you, you know. So you're fighting that. I mean, Adam Bloom said something on stage that I think is very profound and true for me, and I think true for a lot of us. He said, fame's a byproduct of being really good at your job. Now, if I could, you haven't asked the question, but I'll answer my own question. If I could have what I wanted in life, I would earn about £100,000 a year, spend most of my year out of the country, and be known by name. So if I'm chatting up somebody in a bar somewhere in Bangkok, and they said, so how come you're staying in this nice hotel here? Well, because I can afford it. How come? Well, I wrote a book called Shooting on Location that sold 10 million copies. That would be brilliant. And if I didn't want to tell them that, they would never clue. I'd just say, well, retired from the post office, got a pension.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, I come from a rich family or I won the lottery. Do you know what I mean? You've got the choice of letting people know whether you're famous or not. Now, to me, that's what I want, because I don't think I'd tell many people. I'd just quite happily have the perks of being a wealthy person. I still own my yacht. I'd love a bigger yacht, I really would. I'd like about a 60-foot yacht that I could have parties on, and I'd leave it in the Caribbean and go out there 6 months a year when it's cold here. And I'd have all my mates over there. I'd love to be able to afford to fly my mates out there to have fun. But I wouldn't want to open a comedy club there and be the figurehead of it and be the sort of
mine host.
You know, suddenly be, you know, then you start getting famous for the wrong reasons. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what I want and what I can have are probably two different things, but I hope my book gets published. I want people who are interested in me to read it, and I know a lot of comedians are interested or intrigued by the fact that I've had a bit of an interesting life. I want my family to read it, because I've never really sat down and told them what I got up to. And if the general public read it in enough numbers, then they might be interested in come and see me do shows. I would love to do that, and I know it sounds stupid, but if I could put a picture of the book outside instead of a picture of my face, and that gets them in there, that's how I'd rather it. So those who come and see the show know who I am, but passers-by on the street would say, oh, what's in your picture outside the theatre? I'd rather not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not a vanity thing, because it's not that I think I'm particularly ugly or good-looking. I just don't want to be visually known to anyone. I'd rather be anonymous when I want to be.
No, I was in Knightsbridge last week and I saw Billy Joel sitting outside in a cafe wearing a hat. And he had that look of, please don't talk to me.
Absolutely.
And at the same time he was sitting there on his own, and I thought, actually, he probably would like to talk to somebody, but not as Billy Joel.
Yeah, exactly.
Catch 22.
Well, there's two examples I can think of, famous, very, very famous people that have dealt with it very well. One is Paul Newman. Now, he lives, I think it's either on the coast or Lakeside, and he's an early riser. You know, as people in their 80s tend to be. And, you know, he's been famous for God knows how many, 50
forever,
years.
Yeah.
But he said what he does, he gets up in the morning, he walks his dog along the beach, and he always wears one of those, like a hat with flaps on, where the flaps come over
ear
his
flaps,
ears.
Yeah.
He said, and what he'd do, he'd be walking along the beach with his dog, it might be 6, 7 in the morning, people were walking towards him, he puts the flaps down and just skims stones across the water. If they come up and say, what a beautiful dog you've got there, or what a fantastic morning, did you catch the sunrise this morning, he'd talk to them. If they come up and say, oh my God, you're Paul Newman, he'd just basically blank them. Yeah, I'm just walking the dog, alright, because he doesn't need it or want it,
he doesn't want to talk about Paul Newman.
Exactly, yeah. And the other one, and I thought it was fantastic, was years ago I saw Muhammad Ali being interviewed, and they said, when were you happiest in your life? And he said, first time I went to Africa, he said, because I was just a big, handsome black man. They didn't know who I was. He said, anyone that liked me because I was a big, handsome black man. Probably the most handsome black man in the world. But that don't matter. They didn't know I was Muhammad Ali. He said, so if a woman fancied me, she fancied me because I'm a handsome
gorgeous,
black man, not because I'm Muhammad Ali, millionaire boxer. He said, if a guy wanted to talk to me or buy me a drink, that's because he liked me, not because I was Muhammad Ali, the famous boxer. I thought, wow, there's some people on the circuit who crave fame like unbelievably so.
It hurts, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I was working with one the other week and it's painful to watch. He's same age as me and he's depressed because he feels life has passed him by. He's going, and he told me how much he earns. I said, well, look at it this way, mate. You earn double what I earn. People would know who you were on the circuit. Everybody knows you. Everyone loves you, mate. What is your problem? He went, I look at Bill Bailey, I look at Rachel, I should be there. And I went, it just ain't meant to be, mate. I'm sorry about that. I think you're talented. I think you're a gorgeous person. But it ain't meant to be. And there's no point. You're knocking on 50, mate. There's no point in getting yourself in a tizzy about it. Enjoy your life. You know, we're in a beautiful part of the world at the time. We're down in Naples, getting paid to be there, living the life of Riley. And I just said, do you remember when we were talking 15 years ago, when we were both sort of starting out? Now, if somebody said you're going to get paid, 1,500 quid a week to be living in Naples and, having your days off in Naples, living on a luxury cruiser at night, getting fabulous food, everything you want, he went, yeah, but nobody knows who I am. He said, and that will never go away. Nobody knows
he's
who I am.
He's eating away at him.
He's eating away at him, yeah. And he's a lovely fella. I mean, he's spent money on a nice house, and he's got, wife and kids. Now, he's as secure as a person in that regard, but he just, this business of, he wants to be famous desperately. He wants his face up in lights. He would love it if he was sat here and people come on, oh my God, you're such and such, So we totally disagree about it.
Yeah.
And we're at the same sort of level in comedy, if you know what I mean. We are sort of famous within the comedy community. You know who I am without having to know me as a person. You knew who I was when he started the circuit. Within the comedy world, we're both fairly well known, but that's all I want. I don't want to be known by Joe Bloggs on the street, But I would like to spend $10.99 on my book or whatever and help me finance a life. Do you know what I mean? So, I don't know if you can have it both ways, but I think the examples that I gave are how you deal with it if you have to be famous, deal with it with grace and dignity.
Yeah.
Don't whinge about it, don't do that.
I remember someone who worked with Bob Hoskins saying that whenever this guy was... I mean, he works a fair bit, he's on telly every now and again, but he said when he walked into a pub, he'd go, oh shit, I've got all these bloody people going to come and hassle me. And he said Bob Hoskins would just rub his hands together and listen and go, oh great, there's a whole bunch of people that don't know me yet.
Yeah.
And he would just go in there and just like, these are all my mates that I haven't met yet, type of his attitude. Yeah. Whereas this actor's attitude was just, you know, one of horror and fear. And I thought, it's a weird thing, because for me, a good gig is one where people have had a really nice time with the time I've shared with them on stage.
Absolutely, yeah.
And when I come off stage, I don't think I change persona that much.
Yeah.
But when I come off stage, I'm really happy to talk to them. But I sort of sometimes feel I'm talking to them as another person. It's not actually me, even though it is me. Do you know what I mean? You get caught.
Well, one of the conversations I had with this act last week, we were talking about, he's married now with kids, and he's very faithful to her, I must stress. But in his day, say 10 years ago, when we were both single, you know, part of the deal was you do a show on stage with a, it's like a 20 minute line date, isn't it? You're saying, this is what I'm like, this is what I'm like, you know, it's like, you know, if there's any single girls out there, I'll be at the bar, you know, and for
he's
him
cute,
it worked.
Yeah.
And he's a cute guy, and it worked a lot for him. And over the years, I suppose it worked for me to a certain degree, but now I've come to the conclusion, and so has he, I must say, I'm not interested in girls that like Nick Wilty on stage. It's an act. What you see
Crinkle
on stage, that's not the reason you should like me. So the last few girls I've gone out with, and I must say they're all lovely girls, I don't go out with plain girls, I only go out with pretty girls, but generally it's got to be ones that like me and then find out I'm a comedian. Do you know what I mean? Well, they know of me, but they haven't seen me act, so they're not impressed by me. That's the best. That's the best of the best, you know. I want recognition after you see me, but don't go thinking I'm something special when I'm not. And if you see me do 20 minutes at the Comedy Store, do not think I'm like that, and do not sit next to me and think that I'm going to be funny every 5 seconds and have anecdotes and stories about everything under the sun. I don't even blow a chalk, you know.
I was doing a gig a while back, and someone invited me to some event that was happening at the Soho Theatre. I can't remember what it was, some event that they were hosting, and they invited me, and I was really ill and I was tired or whatever, and I went along and it was really nice. I was chatting to a few people, there was a few people there I knew, and then this person came over and sat down next to me and said, if I knew you were really like this, I wouldn't have invited you.
And
I just sat there and I thought, I can't do a 4-hour comedy routine at a party unpaid for no reason.
Exactly. And people who do, and this is something that bugs me, there are a handful of comedians who never ever switch off, and not only that, you don't get a conversation with, what you get is little material. Bits of their bloody routines in conversation, and it bores me rigid. They know who they are. I can't handle them. They're the ones when I get asked to do overseas trips, and I say, who else? And I say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do the next one. I say, I'm not going to spend 2 weeks with somebody doing their act at me, you know, even if they're brilliant acts. Confine it to the bloody stage. I'll tell you a quick story. I was at a party with my last girlfriend, who was this bisexual one, and it was quite a posh party. I've forgotten how we got in, but anyway, it was Daniel Bedingfield's father's party. I'd done a benefit for something, I don't know what it's for, raise money for some cause, and the woman who runs it is Daniel Bedingfield's mum, and his dad was there, and we went to the after show party at the Groucho or somewhere, like, you know, it's free drinks and I'm up for that anytime. So this John Bedingfield, who's Daniel's father, sort of corners me and my girlfriend and says, he said, you seem so happy together. How long have you been together? And we looked at each other, weeks, something like that. And he went, wow, but you seem so happy together. I said, well, we make each other laugh, because she does comedy as well. You know it is, don't you? I won't say it. But anyway, I said, you know, no, we're happy with each other's company. I said, it's great fun, you know, she lives in Amsterdam, so I'll go over there and I sort of live a life of a lesbian, you know, for 3 days with her, and I come back and I'm back to my normal life. I said, and then while I'm away, she's doing her thing. And this Mr. Bedingfield almost became obsessed by us. And he was going, oh my God. And he said, I saw your show tonight, like, and you go all around the world doing this. I went, yeah. And he said, do you earn a good living? I went, yeah, not bad. And he went, and you got a yacht and everything. I went, yeah. He said, you got this beautiful girlfriend who's much, much younger than you. And I said, yeah. And he went, and you're so sort of normal and relaxed. He said, can you do me a favour? Daniel is very successful, but he's not a happy boy. Can you come? He's not at the party, Daniel. He said, can I invite you to a party at Daniel's place? He said, and I'll give you an hour with him. He said, and try and tell him to enjoy success while it's there, because he's got all this fame and fortune.
He's not handling
it. Very well. He said, but you seem to have everything. And I said, no, but I haven't got the fame bit, have I? He went, you are to me, mate. I saw you on stage tonight. He said, 500 people in that room think you're famous. I went, yeah, but it's not the same. Daniel can't walk the street without being recognised. He said, but that's the thing he could do if he wanted to.
Yeah.
He's only got to put on glasses and a hat, and he's just another bloke, you know. Yeah. He said, no, please come over, meet Daniel. He said, I'd love for him to spend an hour with you so you can tell him to enjoy success. Tell him all the places you've been, the things you've done. He should be out there doing that. He's in his mid-20s and he's a multi-millionaire, but he's just trapped in this persona of Daniel Bedingfield. He can't get out of it, you know.
Did you go down there?
No, never did. I think his wife thought me and Lee were a bit full on, you know. I think she thought that if we went down there, we'd turn him into a lesbian or something, I don't know.
Doing whatever. So what's your idea of a bad gig, then?
Dine on my ass, like anywhere else.
No. Is that as bad as it gets for you?
What, dine on your ass is not bad enough?
Oh, no, there's far worse than that. People coming at you with chainsaws, bottles.
Oh, no, following you out. I can handle that. No, if I die on my death because my act didn't work, there are nights when it's unplayable. I died the other week. It was horrendous. So I'm on crutches before they even got to the stage. Somebody said, tell a joke, mate. And I got there, got the crutches. I hadn't thought it through. Which crutch do I put down to pick up the microphone? Anyway, well, I'd done it. Boring. And I stayed up, did my time. It was one of the big comedy clubs in London. Now, that was unplayable for me. I got the material out. I tried to look relaxed. I tried doing my normal stuff. Whatever charm I've got, I tried using, and it wasn't working. They just didn't like me. They didn't like this middle-aged bloke on crutches who didn't refer to the fact he was a middle-aged bloke on crutches.
Mm.
And that was a regret. Now, I couldn't do anything about that. But the next night, I was back to form, because I left one of the crutches behind, went out with one crutch, held a pint in the other one, referred to the fact I've got crutches, made a lame joke about the fact that I've got a gammy leg. Now let's get on with it. This is what I'm like. Don't judge me by my crutches, you know. And I was back to form, but the night it happened, it knocked all the confidence out of me. I just thought, I've lost it. I'm not funny anymore.
Really?
Well, I spoke to a lot of, you know, top name acts, and you have one bad one, you think you've lost it forever. I've been fluky, I've got to wire it up till now, I don't know what's happened. I'm not funny anymore.
Mm.
All it takes is one good one, you're back on track, you know. And I also happen to think that every act deserves to die at least once a year. It's good for you.
Yeah.
It revitalises you, and the next time you think, right, I'm funny, I'll prove it to you, and you work harder. That night I died, it was in one of the big clubs here. I should have thought it through, I should have been nearer the stage. I hadn't thought, they play on intro music, and it ends after 30 seconds. Well, I hadn't reached the stage by that point. I was still trying to fight my way through the audience. I mean, crutches, I hadn't worked out a route to get on. I hadn't thought it through, you know. So I blame myself for it, but it was unplayable once I got up there. I couldn't deal with it. And yet, the best gigs on earth are when it's like that, and you win them over. When it starts off like that, and they hate you, and by the end of it, you're fantastic. You know, that's the best gigs of all, where you win over an unplayable audience, or you watch someone who is fantastic normally have the most horrendous, definitely look at it and think, this can't be done. And then you go on and think, bite my lip, do what I'm good at, and it works, and you go, that's why I'm good. That is exactly why I'm good, because I can turn a bad night into a good night. And fortunately, I mean, I've probably done 5,000 shows in my life, and I could probably count 20 or 30 that were absolute nightmares that were my fault, and about 50 that I had no control over, the sound, the light, the other reasons, you know, horrendous drunk audience, or not knowing some integral thing about, you don't know that there's somebody blind in the front row and you say a blind joke, you know, that sort of thing that, you know, were out of your control. But the ones that I died on my own merit, if you like, are the ones that I hate, because I mean, I could have turned that around. I know that I could have done that, and I didn't. I mean, I'll give you the worst death and the best example of this. I got booked to do about 20 Butlins holiday camps, right? Now, I'm not a Butlins act by any stretch of the imagination, but I thought, I can do that. I can do that. I'll show them that I can do that. The money was spectacularly good. It was much, much more than you'd get doing a normal circuit. And they booked me two midweek gigs for 10 weeks, so I'm earning extra 1,000 or so quid a week.
And you're still doing your weekends?
Still doing my weekends in the clubs I want to be in. I thought, I can do this, right? So my first one is in Skegness, but I'm in Cape Town, South Africa, the night before. So I fly back that morning. I'm suntanned up. I've been out there for 6 weeks. I've been on safari. I've been riding around a Harley Davidson. I'm brown as a berry. I've got all these brilliant jokes about South Africa and safaris and politics. And I thought, oh, bloody Skegness. Oh, well, never mind. I said, I'll do it. I get there and I'm wearing a velvet lizard skin suit that cost me 900 quid in Harrods, right?
I've seen it,
it's gorgeous. It's a lovely suit, isn't it? Yeah. Again, I misjudged the whole thing. My opening line was something about, I said, I'm a bit jet lagged. Do you ever find this, right? The worst thing about being jet lagged, and someone went, posh twat. I went, what? He went, posh twat. I went, what? Just because I've been overseas? He went, bloody South Africa, mate. We've saved up all year to come to Skegness. And it got worse and worse and worse.
We came on to bus and we were grateful.
And there were kids and grannies and, it was a bloody nightmare. And all my jokes that I'd planned were all failing one by one. I'd written this great joke about duty frees. Same react, duty frees, you posh twat. Then it started off. Bloke walked up on stage with a garden gnome, like about a foot and a half high. Put it next to me and left the stage, and I went and I caught up and I got him by the arm and said, what's all that about, mate? He went, even that garden gnome's funnier than you. I went, on this occasion, I'll grant you, that is true. I said, but I ain't going nowhere until they tell me to get off. Is that gnome precious to you? He went, yeah. I threw it over my shoulder, hit the wall and smashed. I went, you set foot on stage, that's what will happen to you. I don't get off until the management tell me to get off, and they just turn the disco on. That was it. No, nothing, not an announcement. Cut my microphone. Disco on. Well, the next day, of course, I get rung up by the guy who booked it, and he said, I had the show go last night, and I went, nightmare from beginning to end. I was appalling. I misjudged the whole thing. I was wearing the wrong clothes, I had the wrong jokes, but I'll be all right on the next one. And he went, there won't be any more, we're pulling all of them. I went, Matthew, best thing you can do to me is set me back to that exact club tomorrow night or whenever, ideally next week when it's a different audience. I'll wear jeans and a t-shirt and I'll do jokes that they will love. Night buses, Jeremy Beadle, you've been served. I've got jokes they will absolutely love, He said, no, apparently you were dreadful. You assaulted somebody. I went, no, I broke a garden gnome. I didn't assault nobody. I threatened him with assault, but I didn't know. I broke his garden gnome. I said, and I would have done me 20 minutes. I would have done 20 minutes of dying rather than get off to prove my point. Send me back there. Anyway, they cancelled all the gigs, but because they were so stroppy about a contract committing me to 20 shows over 10 weeks, I said, well, you've messed up my next 20 weeks, haven't you? My next 10 weeks of gigs. I want my money. He said, no. I said, no, I signed a bloody contract. So what they did, they cancelled all of the shows and gave me half the money for 20 shows that I never did. But then this certain company, beginning with J, didn't book me again for 7 years. Now, to me, I stand by it to this day. Send me back to Skegness, I'll show you.
Give me a chance.
Give me a chance to prove that I can play that audience. Yeah. Yeah, it was a horrendous death. It was a nightmare, but it was all my fault. Totally. There was not the fault of Butlins whatsoever. They booked an act that they thought could play it, and I hadn't thought it through. I'd gone straight on talking about South Africa, safaris, duty free.
To an audience that's going on a bus ride was a big deal.
Saving up all year to have a week in Skegness was their annual holiday.
Yeah.
I was not their cup of tea, but I know I could have been.
Yeah.
And I've worked it out on these cruise ships. You've got to find out what the people are like. If it's a posh P&O cruise, there's bits they ain't going to get. They don't know who half the people are I'm talking about, but they really like me and they keep rebooking me because I've worked out. Yeah, I know my accent doesn't fit in with them, but I've got stuff to say that they like. I can talk about places they've probably been. Then I do like the Ocean Village, which is sort of like a floating housing estate. It's like an Arndale centre at sea, And then I can go back to stuff that I'm familiar with that they like. And, so I've sussed it out. Now, I think I could play Butlins. I think I could play Butlins and I could also play the Oxford Union. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I've got
the
material to mix and match, but I need to know in advance what sort of audience I'm going to get. Now, I hadn't
done that with the South African trip.
I've never been to a holiday camp. I don't know what they're like, I just presume people on holiday, you know, they're just like anyone else on holiday. Well, they aren't the same sort of people on holiday in Cape Town, I know that now. These people haven't just come back from the 6 weeks of safari, you know, I realise that now, but a bit late then, isn't it?
Well, that's brilliant, Nick. I think we'll end on that. Yeah, it's starting to rain as well, it's fantastic.
Yeah.